Let me invite you this morning to go back to the book of Ecclesiastes and again into chapter 8 of this part of God's Word, Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And I think this will be the last message from this series for this year. Looking in December to bring some other passages, other themes related to the Incarnation as we celebrate Christmas. And the end of this chapter seems to be a good stopping point. Lord willing, we'll pick it up next year with chapter 9. But today we'll be focusing our thoughts on Ecclesiastes chapter 8, the second half, starting at verse 10 and down to verse 17. Ecclesiastes 8, 10 to 17 will be our text today. How was your Thanksgiving week? I'm sure you ate a lot of good food and enjoyed a time of rest and refreshment with your family. But maybe some other events marked your Thanksgiving week. As you know, my Thanksgiving week started with my father having a stroke that debilitated his right side. It also included having to get a double brake job on one vehicle and four new tires on another vehicle. It ended with a couple favorite Christmas decorations getting broken. And after something that happened last night, I'm still not clear what, a piece of artwork got knocked off the wall and the glass broke as well. I'm not trying to get you to feel sorry for me. I am trying, though, to illustrate the atmosphere of the text that is before us this morning. It's one of those kind of darker texts here in the book of Ecclesiastes. And the atmosphere is the fact that we live in an imperfect world, a world that is deteriorating, and a world where things are always breaking down and don't do for you what you expect. A world where we are often taken by surprise and disappointed, where things don't go the way we planned, and a world in which we face frustrations and headaches and heartaches of all kinds. And really, most of my examples from this week are trivial compared to the kind of problems that Solomon is raising in our text. You may remember, as we considered a couple weeks ago, the first part of chapter 8, that he was focusing our thoughts on the whole area of our civil authorities, those who are in governmental power over us, and especially the fact that many of those authorities abuse their power and oppress those that they rule. And in fact, if you take a look at verse 9, maybe this will refresh your memory. At verse 9, Solomon says, "All this I observed while applying my heart to all that is done under the sun, when man had power over man to his hurt." That's that oppressiveness, that abusiveness by those who are in civil government, using their power to the hurt of those that they're supposed to be serving in those positions. And Solomon still has that in mind as the backdrop as he moves on into this passage further. Notice that verse 10, it says, "Then I saw the wicked buried." And the way that that begins, the expression translated "then" at the beginning of verse 10, as somebody put it, could be translated this way, "And in such a case, I saw the wicked buried." In other words, in the case of this abusive ruler, I kept observing, and this person eventually died, and he was buried. In other words, he's still thinking of that realm of life, those abusive powers, and he is here immediately going to lament a problem related, a further problem related to those people. And that is one example of a few that he introduces here as he is discussing various life problems. Our theme this morning is living in a broken world. And Solomon is going to be talking about some issues of life that to us appear broken, that in many cases actually are broken and not according to God's original design. And as we work our way through this, we're going to identify three of such realities in this fallen world. And Solomon is going to teach us how to respond to each of them. What do we expect to face as we make our way through life in this broken world? Immediately there in verses 10 to 13, and as I say, still thinking about the government, he exposes for us the success of the wicked. The success of the wicked. Notice how he lays out the problem there in verse 10 once again. Then I saw the wicked buried. They used to go in and out of the holy place and were praised in the city where they had done such things. This also is vanity. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. I recognize that doesn't sound like much of a Sunday after Thanksgiving text. And yet it is what God has for us here as he lays out this initial problem. Actually, you might get the wrong impression when you first read verse 10, and it says, then I saw the wicked buried, and you might be thinking that he's going to be saying, look, even these people that were so abusive, they end up dying, and they're buried, and it's all over, and they're judged. And buried there would speak about how, as he says in other places, death equalizes everybody, and ultimately everybody has to go through that experience. Everybody faces that fate. Well, that isn't quite what he is emphasizing here at the outset. He's not dealing in the first place with their death, but with their burial. And as you may know from the ancient Near East, and to some extent even to our day, it was expected that if you're going to honor an individual after his death, you would give him a proper burial. And a burial was viewed as a good and as an honorable thing to communicate some sense of respect for the person and to have the opportunity to express specifically what that individual was and the impact he made on those people that knew him and that he interacted with. A burial here is actually a sign of remembrance and honor. Instead of somebody who is disgraced, as a few people in the Old Testament were, not being dignified by having been given a burial. This individual, for as cruel as he was in his position of authority, was dignified with a burial. He received honor and probably as well was given the kind of burial that is typically thought to be fit for a king, with a lot of pomp and a lot of ceremony and a sense of honor being bestowed on this individual, despite of the fact that he was such a wicked ruler. And to add to that, on top of his immoral behavior, it says that these people, they used to go in and out of the holy place. He's talking clearly about the wicked, but it says that these kind of people nevertheless used to go in and out of the holy place, probably a reference to the temple itself. In other words, although they ruled with such a heavy hand and in such a selfish and cruel way, nevertheless, they were very active externally in the public worship of God. And they trafficked in there just like everybody else. And they participated in what appeared to be worship of the true and living God. In other words, these people were not only vicious and immoral, they were also hypocrites. On one level, externally, looking like they were giving to God the honor that he was due, but nevertheless, in the details and the activities of their lives, they're described as wicked people here. And then it goes on to say that they were praised in the city where they had done such things. And I need to stop there for a moment. You may be looking at a version of the Bible that says that they were forgotten in the city. And that is one possible way to read this passage according to the standard Hebrew text. However, other manuscripts use a word that means not forget, but a word that means praise. And these two words differ only by one letter. And it's a letter that, as you look at it, would be easily confused as you are making copies by hand of the scriptures. And furthermore, some of your ancient translations of the Old Testament render that in a passive form. That's where you get the idea of they were praised. And as I've looked at this, it seems to me that actually that fits a lot better the context here. You notice that he goes right on to say this also is vanity. And he is lamenting the experience of these people, where if, in fact, these people died and were buried and then were forgotten, you would have thought from his viewpoint that would be a good thing. That that's not a problem, that they're getting their just desserts, that it's good to forget these kinds of people, to shove them out of your memory once and for all, to stop their influence and their legacy upon their death. And yet he looks at what happens there as a vanity, as something negative, not as something positive. And for that reason, especially, I believe that the idea of praised is in view here. In other words, here they are, these people that were wicked rulers, hypocrites, and they're buried and honored. And when they're buried, it's not just a sort of perfunctory thing, but you have people actually singing their praises at their funeral. That seems to be the idea. And so Solomon looks at that and he says, this is vanity. It's a vapor, that key word we've seen so many times, and emphasizing with that image the idea that this is frustrating. I can't get this. Why the world is this way? I find this to be elusive. I can't explain it. It doesn't make any sense that such kind of people would be praised at their funeral, would be honored in this way. It is enigmatic to me. Now, why do people live that way and end up being praised for it at their funeral? Well, here's one reason. It's what it says in verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed speedily, the heart of the children of man is fully set to do evil. In other words, when those people began to live and to act and to rule in that wicked way, there was apparently no higher authority that would bring them to account and bring upon them the sentence that they deserved. And the judgment that they deserved didn't come quickly. And so what was the reaction? This is what happens to all of us when it seems that the consequences that we expected for our sin are not apparent, and they're not just blowing us away right away. What happens? Well, we assume we're going to be okay. We're assuming that probably the judgment is never going to come, that we really have nothing to worry about in the end. And it ends up emboldening people to sin even more. And so they set out on this course of life, and they use the power in the oppressive ways that we have seen here, and they get away with it, and they get away with it for a long time. And on the earth, the judgment actually never comes. They get away with it entirely, and they get away with it even at their funeral. No wonder this man is frustrated. I'm sure you've heard that Fidel Castro passed away on this past Friday. And it has been alarming, some of the praises that have come both from the media and from other world leaders. Here's what the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said. Fidel Castro was a larger-than-life leader who served his people for almost half a century. A legendary revolutionary and orator, Mr. Castro made significant improvements to the education and health care of his island nation. We join the people of Cuba today in mourning the loss of this remarkable leader. Or the Italian President Sergio Mattarella. I learn with deep sadness of the death of Fidel Castro Ruz, a leading figure in his country's history and life of the world. Over the past few years, albeit far away from active politics, he did not fail to make his voice heard on global issues of great importance and relevance, starting with environmental ones. I am sure that his figure will remain alive in the memory of the Cuban people, to which Italy is all bound together by deep feelings of old friendship. Thankfully, other comments are also being made, not the least of which is all the Cubans partying down in Miami. But these sorts of statements are exactly the kind of thing that Solomon is referring to. An oppressive, dictatorial, self-seeking, cruel ruler, not only getting away with it, but being praised at his death. And Solomon, as a ruler who had generally tried to make wise choices and had done a lot for his people, he is totally frustrated and baffled by this sort of response of people. This is one of the great problems that he sees. This is one of the things that's broken in this world, that wicked people, particularly in positions of authority, could be so successful and so honored for it. And how does he encourage us here by his example to respond to that problem? That's what verses 12 to 13 get us into. The response to that problem. He says, though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, yet I know that it will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow because he does not fear before God. There would be a great statement to make on the death of a dictatorial, wicked ruler. And it is striking the way that Solomon frames it here. As you know, in Solomon's teaching, and as he's covering so many areas of life, he finds himself struggling over a lot of issues. And even as we're going to see at the end of this passage, he is not unwilling to say, I don't know. He takes wisdom up to its limits, and he humbly confesses his ignorance at times. He is very frank about his doubts and about the dilemmas of life. And here is one of the few times that he speaks so dogmatically. He says, there are a lot of things I don't know, but this is something I know. Here is one of my convictions. Here is something I have been persuaded about by God. I know this. And when Solomon in this book is so dogmatic about something, I think it calls us to pay special attention. What is he so confident about? That despite any present inequities, and no matter how much an individual sins, right, he says, though a sinner does evil 100 times, he's just using that as a large number to speak of however many times it may be multiplied. And even though he does it for a long time, that is, though a sinner does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, no matter how long this may go on earth, yet I know that ultimately there is going to be retribution. And the retribution is going to work both ways. And he speaks, first of all, about what the righteous are going to receive. In general terms, he says, it will be well with those sort of people. And then in verse 13, very plainly, it will not be well with the wicked, neither will he prolong his days like a shadow. That's curious, because before he had spoken of if he does evil 100 times and prolongs his life, and he says he's not going to prolong his life like a shadow. That's not going to happen. There's another one of these images. What does he mean by saying like a shadow? It brings to mind the sunset, the ending of a day, when shadows tend to lengthen because of the nature of the light that is shining at that time. And the point is that there is going to be an end to all of this. It's not going to go on forever. It's not going to go to the ultimate, just like the sunset brings you to the end of the day. There is going to be, in the plan of God, a stopping point for the prosperity and the honor of the wicked. And even though at this point Solomon does not give us a lot of information about what that involves, and I'm sure we know a lot more about it than he did during his lifetime, I believe this statement is a confession of faith in the afterlife. Because you have so many of these people getting away with it up through their death and through their funeral, what else is left where retribution will be meted out but some other dimension in the afterlife when God is going to make all things right? Solomon says, I know that that's going to come. I was encouraged by a quote by D.A. Carson I ran across this week. I think captures in New Testament terms what Solomon is saying. He said, I'm not suffering from anything that a good resurrection can't fix. And this was not something that was revealed for the first time in the New Testament. You do have indications that Old Testament people had some sense of the afterlife and even of a bodily resurrection and a vindication by God. You think of a passage like Psalm 73, which is about this very theme of the prosperity of the wicked, where Asaph was so troubled by this problem. And everything changes, he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I discerned their end. And he becomes aware of how quickly the judgment of God takes over and overwhelms those people. And as for himself, he goes on to make this statement, you guide me with your counsel and afterward receive me to glory. And this is an Old Testament believer speaking of the glory that he would enter into after this earthly life. This is the bottom line assurance that Solomon is giving us here. And it is the way that he's able to cope with the twistedness that so often characterizes those who are in authority and get away with that kind of wickedness. He says the day is coming. If they don't repent in this life, this is the fate that they're going to face. You're familiar, I'm sure, with many of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. And one of the things that you want to keep in mind whenever you're reading the book of Revelation is that it is written primarily to Christians in the first century who are being persecuted, who are facing a lot of pressure from the authorities, whose authorities are beginning to use their power to crush them. And throughout that book, there is this big tension between the people of God and the powers of the world. And so much of what is happening at the end of Revelation is that God is crushing ungodly governments in the earth, as well as ungodly religions. And coming out of that, and really as a way of encouraging persecuted Christians to persevere. That's the initial application of the book of Revelation. You find these sobering words in Revelation chapter 20. Solomon didn't know to say this exactly, but this is what he is pointing us toward. Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. And from his presence, earth and sky fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. And then another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged by what was written in the books, according to what they had done. And the sea gave up the dead who were in it. Death and Hades gave up the dead who were in them. And they were judged, each one of them, according to what they had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And if anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. That is a New Testament version of Ecclesiastes chapter 8. These stunning and soul-searching words challenging everyone to consider, where will you be in the end? What will be your fate? What will be the divine determination about you? Will you be among those who, because of the sins that are exposed, having been written in those books, is going to be cast into the lake of fire? Or you'll be among those who, because of the work of Christ, your name has been written down in the book of life, and therefore you will be released from this judgment, and you will enter into the eternal blessing that Solomon had been suggesting so long ago. These are the questions that a passage like this urges us to consider, not just take comfort that right is going to be done in the earth someday, but also, where will you stand on that day? What will be your fate? Are you quite sure that your name is written in the book of life? Have you turned from your sin and embraced the only way to life, the one that actually describes himself as the life, Jesus Christ, Son of God, come to earth to live in our place, to take upon himself the death that we deserve, to rise from the dead, to assure all believers of the victory over death that will be ours as well? These are the questions that Ecclesiastes is pushing us toward. And if we go back to Ecclesiastes, it will do us well to notice how it is that he describes believers and unbelievers. He doesn't speak specifically about faith here. He doesn't speak about faith in Jesus Christ. How does he describe those who are the people of God and those who are not? Look at it again in verse 12. It says, "It will be well with those who fear God because they fear before him. And the wicked are going to be judged." Why? Verse 13, "because he does not fear before God." Three times he says that the dividing line between these groups is the question, are they people that have this posture toward God? They fear him. Or more specifically, it says they fear before him. We have talked a little bit about the fear of God, and we're going to be seeing this again. We keep seeing these little hints of it along the way before we get to the big emphasis on it in chapter 12. What does the fear of God mean? Right now, I just want to highlight the expression fear before him, in that that communicates that this is somebody who lives in the constant awareness of God. That as you make your way through life, you never get away from the fact that God is supreme, that he is your creator, that you are accountable to him, and that shapes the choices that you make in life. It doesn't mean that the thought of God is 24/7 constantly on our minds. You can only think about so many things at one time. But it is that the reality of God permeates your consciousness and is the deciding factor when it comes to the direction of your life and your choices. I was struck this week when I was reading in the book of Exodus, again, the story of Pharaoh taking so much power, abusing the people of Israel in chapter 1. He got that situation with the midwives, and he is ordering them to kill these babies. And how does it describe their approach and how they dealt with that? It says, "But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live." Yes, they made a choice not to kill those babies. And they made a choice to disobey the king. But what was it that led them to do that? It was their awareness of God. It was God is the one in charge here. It's not ultimately Pharaoh. And when these two authorities are in tension with each other, I must obey God rather than men. And the fear of God here is defined not simply in terms of an attitude, but the way that that attitude is demonstrated to be real and to show that that is something that genuinely has you in relationship to God is, okay, how do you respond when you're under pressure? What are the decisions of your life? The fear of these women, the fear of God, was demonstrated by the choices that they made. Now you say, well, how do I go about getting this fear of God in me? Where does this come from? How do I carry out such a life of being conscious of God and living in His presence all the time? Well, it is such a blessing that when in later books of the New Testament, the Lord speaks more specifically about salvation, and He promises the great new covenant whereby through Christ we are reconciled to Him. As a part of it, and as one way of describing it, He actually brings in this whole business of the fear of God. This is how Jeremiah 32 describes it. When the Lord is announcing, predicting His coming work, He says, I will give them one heart and one way, that they may fear me forever, for their own good and the good of their children after them. I will make with them an everlasting covenant that I will not turn away from doing good to them, and I will put the fear of me in their hearts that they may not turn from me. You know how you get the fear of God? You get the fear of God by being born again. You get the fear of God by God intervening in your inner man and remaking you inside and instilling in you that awareness of Him and that concern for Him and that sense of your accountability to Him. And it is those who have experienced the new covenant, or what the New Testament calls the new birth, that end up fearing God and therefore can be assured by what Ecclesiastes 8 is saying, that in the end it's going to be well with you. No matter how downtrodden you may be by your government, no matter how much unfairness you may face in life, it will be well with you if you are experiencing this posture toward God. I really do fear Him. And I'm going to make my life's choices by His power, by His grace, following His lead instead of being pressured by this culture that's around me that is pushing me in the other direction. This is the dividing line. It will be well with those who fear Him. Now, the next section of this passage is going to broaden out beyond the problem of the prosperity of the wicked. And it's going to talk as well, more specifically, about the righteous not getting what you would think they would get. We've been talking mostly about the wicked, and now we've been transitioning more to the righteous, and this new section is going to get into that more. It's not only that wicked people are praised in the headlines when they die, but it is also that the death of truly commendable people, God's people, believers, God-fearers, they typically don't register in the eyes of the world. And yet the issue is much broader than just what happens at funerals, even. This kind of injustice is prevalent throughout their lives, and it comes across in many circumstances of life. And so we're moving from the prosperity or the success of the wicked to number two, the reversal of justice, verses 14 to 15, that can happen in many ways. Look at the problem laid out there in verse 14. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. It's a vapor. It is an enigma. This doesn't make any sense to me. What doesn't make any sense to me? The reversal of things. The overturning of justice, where the righteous get what the wicked deserve and the wicked get what the righteous deserve. We see that played out in so many realms of life. Whether it is in business or politics or the media or education, typically, it is the godless who are in positions of influence and who are advancing their agendas. Meanwhile, believers in those same areas of life, They tend to be a marginalized and even a persecuted minority. Now, if Christian people suffer because they aren't hardworking or because they have engaged in dishonesty, that's one thing. But often what people, Christian people, suffer for is precisely because of their ethics. It is precisely because of their efforts to conduct themselves in these different areas of life in light of a biblical frame of reference, in light of a biblical worldview. And yet, what do they get for it? Often what they get is what actually the wicked deserve. It's a reversal. It's totally the opposite of what you would be led to believe. And Solomon lays this down as a fact and something that is evidently common enough in the world that it really bugs him. And I wonder the degree to which that reality really sinks in. We get so offended and so alarmed when the world gets away with sin and the world makes fun of Christians. Like, this is something so shocking and horrible. How could this happen? What about my rights? What about the Christian heritage of this country? Folks, this is more normal historically. And even though it is a sad thing to see respect for God and His Word degenerate in a country like ours, on the other hand, what should be surprising in light of Scripture is that it ever was honored and respected and had a measure of influence. That is actually an anomaly in the history of humanity. This is more normal. And this is the kind of thing we ought to learn to expect. And I want to encourage, as I've done a few times in this series, I want to encourage our young people about this very thing. What is your mentality about what the world is like that you're heading into someday? What are you anticipating is going to be the treatment that you're going to receive from the world at large if you are a believer in Jesus Christ and striving to live for Him and honor Him in your vocation? It may be that God in His grace chooses to give you a lot of success. If that happens, then all the glory should go to Him, and you ought to rejoice in His goodness and not take it for granted and really live a life of praise because of it. But if you do intend to be faithful to Christ in a godless world, you need to be prepared now as a young person for the likelihood that you are going to suffer for it in some way. It may cost you someday a promotion. It may cost you a raise. It may cost you your job someday. That is nothing unusual. That is nothing alarming. That is exactly the way it was in the early church. And Solomon is lamenting about it here way back 3,000 years ago. Biblically, that kind of thing is more the norm than the exception, and it is just one of the burdens of life in a broken world that God's people have been dealing with for millennia. You want to be preparing yourself mentally that should not surprise you, but that's actually one of your expectations, that pressure is going to be there, that injustice is going to be there. This is just the way life is in the world for Christian people. Now you say, well, I need to accept that. I need to prepare myself for it. When it happens, how do I respond or how do I cope with this? And actually, in this passage, the response he gives us in verse 15 is probably not what you would have expected. You might have expected him to say, well, you're going to be treated unfairly and the wicked are going to prosper. But, you know, remember what I said about ultimate justice and live for eternity. Be assured that God is righteous and He will make all things right in the end. That thought is there. He's already stated that. He's given you that perspective, that ultimate perspective. But that's actually not what he says next. Listen to what he says. Here is one important part of responding to injustice. Verse 15. And I commend joy, for man has nothing better under the sun but to eat and drink and be joyful. For this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. You know what he says? While on the one hand he's saying it could be get rough out there and you could be treated unfairly and that's just the way it is. Application. Enjoy your lunch. Enjoy whatever it is that's before you. Take heart in these material, temporal blessings. That just doesn't seem like it fits. That doesn't seem like how we would think. You know what he's saying? Here's another way to put it. Don't focus so much on justice. Don't expect justice necessarily in this life. Don't focus on the justice that you're not getting. Focus on the grace that you are getting. And God's grace in your life has taken many forms. Here he is dwelling on the temporal blessings that are a product of the grace of God in your life. View those blessings as tokens of God's tender care for you. God doesn't owe you wealth. God doesn't owe you a high position in society. God doesn't owe you success. And yet for every one of us, he has loaded us up with any number of blessings temporally. Take them for what they are. These are indications of God's favor on your life. This is your portion for right now, for today. Partake of it as an act of worship toward the God who gave you these things out of his loving heart. And this is where our passage ties into Thanksgiving. Okay? So it does have something to do with this time of year. Because isn't that what a Thanksgiving feast is? We gather together to eat turkey and stuffing and sweet potato casserole and pumpkin pie and drink iced tea and whatever else. Because we like those foods, yes, but the whole idea is we are celebrating. We are celebrating the goodness of God by heartily entering into his blessings. And we're doing this with an awareness of where these things came from and as a way of celebrating his grace and provision in our life. That's exactly Thanksgiving. Is so much the book of Ecclesiastes and this theme of enjoyment that we have seen a number of times. And he says about that specifically, that this joy, these celebrations, it will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. Like that turn of phrase, it goes with him in his toil. You could say that that joy accompanies you in your toil. A God-centered enjoyment of earthly things will accompany you in your lifelong toil. It will be your friend. It will be your companion. As you going through whatever unfair experiences, whatever suffering experiences, you are taking whatever good things God has given you and consciously thanking him for them and entering into them with a spirit of joy. That is going to buoy you when those other things would threaten to drown you. It is going to lighten your spirit when you are weighed down with so many burdens. And what this passage is urging us to do in response to the unfairness of life is to focus on what we have rather than on what we don't have. And I would say that that idea has application way beyond just matters of technical injustice. It's a perspective that will rescue my thinking whenever I am frustrated by whatever negative circumstances I may face. How do you respond when things don't go the way you think they ought to? Whether it's with your country or with your job or with your family, our natural bent is to dwell on the negatives and therefore to become anxious or depressed or angry. And here's what Ecclesiastes keeps just insisting on and just keeps pounding this in. It says, look, very often things are not going to go the way you want them to. You live in a world that is cursed by sin. You need to accept that fact, and you need to accept that even when you make good and worthy efforts to improve things, they might end up failing as well. They may break in the end. And instead of dwelling on that and letting those negatives dominate your thinking, you need to learn to enjoy moment by moment those things that in God's grace you have received that are good and that are pleasant despite the curse of sin. Take those things in thoughtfully, spiritually, even the physical. Take it in spiritually as an assurance that God still loves you and is still committed to your good. And you're going to discover that that kind of gratitude is therapeutic. And folks, I am preaching to myself as much as to you. Gratitude is intended to be therapeutic. When we consciously turn away from things we don't like and appreciate the things we can enjoy from the hand of God, it has a calming, a soothing, a healing effect. And as our passage closes, we're going to discover one other thing that is therapeutic. It's a fact, it's a doctrine that initially we might view as a problem, but ultimately it's a comfort. It's a theme that we have seen a number of other times in Ecclesiastes as well. As far as life in a broken world, this morning we've talked about the success of the wicked that we struggle with. We've talked about the reversal of justice that we struggle with as well. And finally here in verses 16 to 17, the mystery of God's providence. This is not just a matter of human beings being wicked and being unfair and sort of having the upper hand and treating us badly. It's actually much bigger than that. There's just a whole mess of things that are somehow worked into the sovereign plan of God, and we just don't know what in the world God is doing. The mystery of God's providence. Look at it, verse 16. When I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, how neither day nor night do one's eyes see sleep, then I saw all the work of God, that man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. However much man may toil in seeking, he will not find it out. Even though a wise man claims to know, he cannot find it out. And you see very broad, universal kind of statements here, all encompassing the efforts that he had made. He talks about how he hasn't slept. He's kept them up all night, meditating on these things. He says, I saw all the work of God that there is to be seen under the sun. However man may toil, this is a very broad term. He's been exhaustive as a human being could be. We've got this whole book about it. And his conclusion about all that is all-encompassing as well. Very strong statements that for all of our philosophical and theological efforts, we simply do not have the ability to probe fully the ways of God. And specifically here, he's been talking about the injustices of life that are woven into the providence of God for any one of us. To predict when that's going to be taken care of and when and how God's going to make it all right and why he allowed this in the first place. We can't figure it out. That's part of life in a broken world, is that we are limited and God's a lot bigger than us and we don't understand how sin and its effects are actually working together for good in his plan. And so how do we respond? Well, you know what human nature instinctively does when you say that and you make these bold statements about God being sovereign and not owing us an answer, God being the ruler and man as a subject. Human nature instinctively resists that. And we want to push ourselves forward. We want to keep searching for explanations. We feel like we have to have this figured out and it has to be under our control. And if we can't do that, some people, they react by actually rejecting God altogether. We call them atheists. And one of the big ideas that drives atheists is precisely what we're finding in this passage about the injustices and problems of life that we can't figure out. If God were real, and if God were great, surely this wouldn't happen. Well, here's what C.S. Lewis said about that. It was his own testimony about what he was like and what he was thinking as an atheist. He said, "My argument against God was that the universe seems so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust?" And he came to realize, if I reject God, then there's no basis for saying anything is just or unjust. There's no standard. There's no lawgiver out there. And I've just cut my legs out from under me if I'm using injustice to attack God. We call that basically the presuppositional argument for the existence of God, that he is under everything and he holds everything together, even our arguments against him. Because if he's not there, then there's no reason to argue against him. There is no abstract universal principle out there like justice that God must abide by. So we don't want to respond that way. Christians, sometimes their response is that they're tempted to water down the doctrine of God's sovereignty and to end up making kind of the deciding factor in all of this the matter of human will and human choice. And you know where that leaves you? That leaves you in utter hopelessness. If everything is riding on what man is or isn't going to do, that leaves you in a position of depending on man instead of God. And of saying God is not in control of his enemies. God doesn't really rule over sin. Or if things go well and man chooses right, of saying, well, man was smart enough and man was good enough to figure this out and man fixed the problems in the world by his ingenuity and his good thinking. Is that really the world you want to be living in? One that man could destroy, or that if man improves, he gets the ultimate credit for? This is not the biblical worldview. You end up really in a position of hopelessness with a man-centered theology that way. This passage leaves you what? It leaves you humbled and silent before a God who can do whatever he chooses to do, and a God that you will never fully understand, and a God before whom you just quietly throw yourself toward and trust. And at a certain point, Solomon is saying, look, stop asking your questions. It becomes foolish to stay up all night. And certainly don't say more than you know, even though a wise man claims he knows. He doesn't really. Just be quiet at a certain point. Stop theorizing. Stop speculating. Stop explaining. Stop philosophizing. Accept that God is way bigger than your little mind. And that idea of humility and trust, those words summarize the attitude that Solomon is displaying for us here and throughout Ecclesiastes. It is the most foundational attitude that we need to cultivate as we live in a broken world. How do I make my way through this broken world? The bottom line answer is you trust a God that is sovereign and that may or may not choose to give you the answers, and it's okay. And I was reminded of this week with this situation with my dad that was pretty surprising. And Monday morning, I was at the hospital and had to leave at a certain point. And being in the hospital, if anybody is sad, but especially with an older person that's so vulnerable and seems so helpless, I walked away, and the last thing I saw was his face, closed eyes, and sleeping. He hadn't had the best day so far, and just kind of sad, really walking away, wondering what's going to happen. And I was leaving because I had to go to a chapel service that was a Thanksgiving praise service. And I didn't really feel like going to a Thanksgiving praise service at that point. But there was a point in that service that the Lord really ministered to me, and we were singing the song In Christ Alone. And we came to that line that says, from life's first cry to final breath, Jesus commands my destiny. And folks, that is it. That is where Solomon leaves you. He didn't use the name Jesus, but this is where it's pointing. Jesus commands your destiny. It's okay. You can trust despite these mysteries and the iniquities of life.